What's up, Bitcoiners? Today's episode with Maurizio De Bartolomeo, the Chief Strategy Officer of Ledin.io, is brought to you by Ledin, a better home for your Bitcoin. Ledin is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. With industry-best interest rates on savings, use your Bitcoin as collateral for loans, or double your Bitcoin stack with their Buy2X program. And Ledin raises the bar for transparency in the industry with proof of reserves attestation. Not yet a Ledin client? Start earning 9% on your USDC and 6.1% on your first two Bitcoin. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast get an exclusive offer of $50 free in USDC when you become a Ledin user and take out a Ledin loan using our link. Learn more, sign up, and get earning at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. I'm really excited to share this conversation that I recently had with Maurizio. We go hard on Venezuela, Chavez, Bitcoin savings, credit, collateralized loans, the pros and cons, the risks, the benefits, the ins and outs of the industry, El Salvador, Maurizio's background, and more. I really enjoyed getting to know Maurizio and working with the team over at Ledin for the last few months. And I think you guys would really like getting to know Maurizio too. So now let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Maurizio De Bartolomeo.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Maurizio De Bartolomeo is the co-founder and chief strategy officer of Ledin.io. Ledin provides financial products with a mission to help clients across the globe unlock the power of digital assets to build wealth for the long term. Operating in over 100 countries, Ledin offers interest-bearing savings accounts and Bitcoin-backed loans, enabling clients to access dollars or additional Bitcoin without needing to sell any of their existing holdings. Maurizio is the author of Why Proof of Reserves is Important to Bitcoin, published in Bitcoin Magazine. He grew up in Venezuela, where he and his family learned about Bitcoin. Now based in Canada, Maurizio holds HBA and MBA degrees from the Richard Ivey School of Business. Maurizio, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great, Cedric. Thanks for having me. I've actually been looking forward to coming on the show.
Yeah, I'm super excited to chat. First off, I'm really proud to have you guys, Ledin and your team, as a sponsor. Since we've gotten together for this partnership, I've done my own research. And I've really gotten to like what I've found out, and I've grown to appreciate your approach to things and Ledin's philosophy. And I'd really like to get into that this evening. And I'd love to start with your background being from Venezuela and kind of where I want to maybe start from there, just because I don't know the timing of everything, is how you ended up leaving Venezuela, maybe for Canada. Maybe that's an inflection point to start at.
Definitely. Yeah. So I'll give you a bit of my background. So yeah, as you mentioned, I grew up in Venezuela. That's where I was born and raised. Actually, a lot of my family is still down there, which sounds crazy. But some of them really enjoy, there's parts of their life down there that are still quite enjoyable, in the middle of the whole mess. Hmm. But anyway, I grew up in this town right in the middle of Venezuela called Barquisimeto. Venezuela was a beautiful place to grow up. I mean, this, particularly this town that I had the luck and privilege of growing up in. But when Chavez comes into power, and we can talk a little bit about what got Chavez into power, because I think that's also, that warrants a conversation, because he didn't just, it wasn't just like he appeared out of nowhere. There were a lot of reasons that led to him becoming so popular. But once he starts taking over, a lot of people could see the writing on the wall, and when he takes office, many Venezuelans thought he was going to be a one-term affair, right? Like some guy that's just in 4 years, gets kicked out, no major deal, no democracy, the country kind of goes back on the rails. And many families, including mine, made the decision to spend a few years abroad, kind of like vacationing, while, you know, this person did his thing and kind of, you know, got booted. And my family moved to Florida. So we spent a couple of years in Miami. I did grades 9 and 10 in Florida. But at the time, it was really hard to manage a remote business, especially in Venezuela. And so my dad's business, you know, he knew that he had to go back. And it was actually really hard to have make income in Venezuela and like afford a life in Miami. It wasn't really, it works the other way around, but not really, you know, in that sense. So so my family made the decision to go back, even though Chavez had a few years in his term. My, you know, I went back and I had to finish my high school in Venezuela. But by the time I did that, it was clear that this guy wasn't going anywhere. You know, it was becoming increasingly clear that this guy wasn't going anywhere and I wanted out. And I really, you know, at the time I thought what I really wanted was to go back to Miami. And, and you know, I'm kind of happy that it didn't work out that way. But what ended up happening was I had a relative here in Toronto that my dad was really close to. And he was like, why don't you go visit your aunt and check out Canada and go see schools in Canada. And it was actually all quite serendipitous because I wound up in Canada, I think it was sometime in like mid-September. The school year had already begun and I started going to universities and they told me it was like a really hard year to get into universities here because there were two graduating cohorts of classes that were competing for schools. And something weird happened in Ontario, which is a particular province that I ended up at, where they unwound grade 13. They used to have 13 grades. So they unwound grade 13 and that was the year that they were unwinding it. So there were twice as many applicants going into school. And so they were like, forget it. I mean, you know, you could, you know, there's two ways of getting into the school. You know, you transfer from your foreign school or you actually apply as a Canadian grad. And so based on what's happening this year in the Canadian grad scene, he's like, your best bet is to go back home, you know, start in a university down there and then, you know, hope to transfer in once in the future to a Canadian school. So I was like, okay, great. That was kind of the same answer I got across the board. So I was like, okay, well, you know, I don't really feel like doing another year of high school. So I'm just going to, you know, pack my bags and see if I can get down to Miami somehow. and so at the time, I can't forget which, I forget exactly what happened, but something broke down or something, there was like a big protest that broke up in Venezuela or some military person attempted to overthrow Chavez or something. People took this, like there was something really bad that happened. And my dad calls me that night and he goes, I was supposed to fly back the next morning. And he goes, do not, you are not flying back. I'm canceling your flight. Like you cannot fly back. Like you don't understand this country's, you know, you have to stay. Like whatever you have to do, whether it's high school, it's like, I don't care, you know, find a way to stay there and get into university up there. And I was like, okay. I woke up the next day that my aunt had made me a list of schools to go see. And I was kind of, I was really, you know, thrilled about this idea. So I was like, whatever. I just like crumpled a note and I go out and look out the window and there's this building that says high school. And I'm like, okay, damn. So anyway, I wound up in this high school, the open arms, they took me in. It's called the York School. Actually, it's a great school here in Toronto. And I did my grade 12. I wound up at the University of Western Ontario, which is the school that has the Ivy Business Program. I ended up getting into that program. And that's where I met Adam, who, you know, is my best friend, essentially, and became the co-founder of Ledin with me later on. But that's how I wound up in Canada in the first place. And, you know, I was essentially one of, you know, many other Venezuelans who were in some ways the first to leave. You know, we were sent out on a mission to kind of build a potential safety net to yank out our families in case things went south. And a lot of people, my year actually did the same. And that's why the Venezuelan diaspora is so spread out right now across the globe. You know, I have friends in places ranging from like Mexico, Patagonia, Barcelona, Malaga, Peru, Chile, you know, you name it. There's a little Venezuela in most cities right now. Mm-hmm. Most people by now know Venezuela and that got to their city, Russian, you know, running away from communism. It used to be this sort of niche, you know, subset of, you know, you never heard of Venezuelan migrants prior to Chavez. And I find that amazing. Like Venezuelans hadn't had their migratory moment. We were all kind of bundled in the country because we had it really good. But now, you know, lo and behold, like everyone else, you know, we're spread all over.
Yeah. So much to unpack there. I find it really interesting about the Venezuela diaspora, that kind of like this underground network or railroad to kind of make connections and find opportunities and build lives elsewhere, these little Venezuelas. Well, when you left Venezuela for the first time around ninth grade, what was the gravity of that situation for you? Was it, hell no, I don't want to go on. I want to stay with my friends. Was it, I get what's going on here. Did you have younger siblings? I know you have brothers. Were they not understanding what's going on?
So my youngest brother probably had no clue. I think he was in, so I was in grade nine. He must've been in grade one, you know? So he was tiny. He probably didn't even comprehend why we were leaving or what was happening. To him, it was just like a different place with, you know, a different house with different toys and, you know, and actually I shouldn't say that because he did have to go to a brand new school and a brand new language. He had it probably tougher than all of us because he was the one that, you know, was kind of had less ability to comprehend what was happening. So just had to really adapt. For my brother and I, it was a challenge, I guess I would say, as it would be for any other person moving high schools or moving countries. You know, you kind of want to fit in. You kind of want to be with it. You go from being in, like, you know, you have your circles, you have your friends, and you kind of know how things work and how society kind of how to move around and who the bully is, and, you know, and so now you have to kind of go in and map it out all over again. And so it's I guess it's as uncomfortable as it would be for anyone moving. And at the time, you know, we didn't have I don't want to date myself, but I don't really even think we had cell phones at the time. Or we were just starting to get them. So it wasn't like you would, you know, we had ICQ and stuff and MSN Messenger. And that was really kind of what prompted a lot of that connectivity. But it was hard. But I actually, to be honest, it was really hard. But after, by the second year, I was really loving it. You know, I kind of had found my way. I kind of got how things worked, and I was really impressed at like a system that worked, you know, like to me, it was very, like, even in Venezuela, even like the best schools, like even, you know, the top private schools, you would look at like their soccer teams or like even the places where they would practice, and, you know, there were some dingy fields and, like, you know, their kits weren't all nice, mm-hmm. and all that stuff. But you got to the Florida and it was like everybody was like sponsored by Adidas, and you had like your trainers that come in and like wrap your ankles. And I was just like, oh man, like these guys are like the real deal. So I was really passionate about staying in sort of North America and learning, with always with the dream of bringing it back. Right. And I think that, like, a lot of people miss that. Like, As a person, you know, back then the dream wasn't ever to like leave for good. The dream was to like understand how to operate at a higher sort of standard and then bring that back, right? Because there were so many successful, like, success stories of people that were like, oh, replicated a model in a different country for whatever, like, you know, Dunkin' Donuts, or like, you know, you copy, you know, there was a guy in my town that he copied basically McDonald's before McDonald's got there. And this thing was called, his chain was called Troppy Burger or Troppy Burger or whatever. And he made like a little chain of, so anyway, all I'm trying to say is, like, the dream was really always to go back and build, but you know, given how things shook out, that wasn't really an option.
Yeah. It seems like it kind of helped you build or form independence. I mean, you had to go back to Venezuela, and then he even chose to leave again and moved around quite a bit, Toronto, Miami, and you're kind of like learning, like you know, remapping, doing your own research, figuring out your own way. I can't help but wonder, because it seems like your dad provided a lot of, you know, sort of the recognize the time to leave. And at some point he struggled with maybe having to go back. But it seemed like he shielded you guys at least from a lot of that. I wonder, you know, how hard it was on him to kind of juggle those decisions to tear you guys out of Venezuela, then bring you guys back after you're loving Miami.
No, it was, listen, I thank him every day. And I think, yeah, it's funny because I see so many of the conversations that, I'm not trying to be alarmist here. And I don't want people to think that I'm drawing parallels and that the United States is going to fall down a cliff anytime soon. I really think it's important to debunk that, because I think while inflation is an economic phenomenon, hyperinflation is entirely a political phenomenon. And we can get into that distinction and why I think that, you know, in my humble opinion, we're still very, very far away from anywhere near that happening in the US. But going back to what I think my dad, one of the things my parents did that was incredibly forward-thinking was getting us additional passports. So my dad is Italian. My dad's from Italian descent. My grandparents are Italian. You know, early on, we were able to get the Italian citizenship basically through our lineage. Right. And our parents worked really hard at that, so much so that by the time Chavez came, you know, we had our passports ready to go. And it was funny because those processes take years. So like for us to have had those things ready, like they had to been thinking about this from, you know, way back. And sometimes I fast forward to now, you know, and people talk about this, people talk about, oh, you know, I'm going to have potentially get another passport, or, oh, I'm thinking about moving, or, oh, and it sounds, it's funny because you see a lot of the stuff, like some trends are clearly still there. I find that really, really fascinating. Especially when I see, like to me, this concept of being able to borrow money and reinvest it, like being able to borrow money at a rate lower than inflation, which is effectively what's happening right now. When you're able to borrow money at a rate lower than inflation, people go crazy. As it naturally should, because it's a no-brainer trade. Inverted. Right.
Yeah.
And so when that's happening, it's very hard to rein back the economy, right? Because you have borrowing rates that are, you know, you have people that are refinancing their mortgages at like, you know, 1-2%, and they're just turning right around and redeploying that in the stock market, or YOLOing into, you know, GameStop or Dogecoin or whatever the case may be, because they're getting free money essentially. But anyway, yeah. You know, many verticals or many tangents on this conversation.
I'm going to choose one. I have to ask, you brought it up. And so what got Chavez into power? It's confounding, especially, you know, I'm not from South America. So I'd love to hear that point of view. And I don't hold you accountable for the official narrative either, but I just would love to hear your perspective.
Yeah. So Venezuela is one of these countries where, you know, because we had a quite successful or abundant, it's an oil economy, basically, right? And you know, we go through the booms and busts of oil, right? So I think what happened in Venezuela was, you know, naturally, if you look at not just Venezuela, I would challenge a lot of people to actually do this because it's actually quite insightful. Go into the history books of any particular oil country and look at their political history, and then overlay that with the chart of oil prices. And you will find in many cases that when oil drops and essentially remains that way, like when oil has like a steep downturn, there tends to be a change in government, a revolution, you know, a big over changing of the guards or something of the sorts, something of the likes, because people get really upset. It's like an economy that, you know, it's like, you know, throwing a party and then, you know, you bring all the alcohol and then, you know, all the party favors. And then all of a sudden you leave all the party and everybody at the party is like, wait a second, what happened? And then oil goes priced back up. And then whoever happened to be at that time is seen as the guy who brought, you know, started the party again. And so you're kind of at the whims, not always of your efficacy as a, you know, government,
right,
but of essentially the price of oil. And so what ended up happening with Chavez was like a circumstance of unfortunate events, like a sequence of unfortunate events that, you know, I would challenge that, you know, this probably, it would be very hard to repeat this in history again, just because of the unlikeliness of this whole thing. But anyway, Chavez starts as when oil, you know, oil prices drop, people are disenfranchised. Venezuela has a lot of, I shouldn't disregard or not bring up the fact that Venezuela had a lot of social inequities. For example, there were a lot of farmers in parts of Venezuela that were very wealthy, and these farms would employ, you know, 300 to 400 people in a remote location, but these guys wouldn't build a school for these families, for these kids to get educated, right? They would treat them very poorly, right? And there was a lot of inequality in that sense. So I don't want to pretend that was not happening, because you have to see that as a fuel to the fire. The right. other thing that was happening in Venezuela at the time that's very important to people understand is that, similarly, and perhaps in some ways as some countries, their politics has been essentially limited to two groups. And they are two groups of people that grow up in a particular part of the country, have a particular group of friends, come from a particular family, you know, the son of the person somehow happens to be the right person to get reelected. So it's like, it's all limited to like almost like a caste of society. It's not necessarily stated in that clear, defined way, but it is very limited. If you look at Venezuelan history, most governance are like European looking, you know, white guys, you know, and so, you know, fair skin, you know, and so like light eyes, like the people that, you know, if you look at what the average Venezuelan, the average citizen of Venezuela, that's really not many times what the average citizen of Venezuela looks like, right? And so that, you know, keep in mind that that's what politicians have looked like, and that's what their narrative and their tone and their demeanor has been, right? Overlaid with the fact that the economy is in shambles because we have this, oil prices are coming down. There's a big social inequalities, you know, all these things are happening, right? So along comes this guy who, in the midst of gets better. So this whole thing was happening, and Carlos Andrés Pérez, the president at the time, just tries to raise the prices of fuel, of gasoline. The people go crazy in Venezuela, like massive protests erupt. And this guy who was at the military, the parachute division, Chavez, tries to stage a coup. At this time, he fails. Okay, he goes to jail, and he becomes he goes viral. I guess the equivalent of going viral at the time, because he says, "Unfortunately, for now, the objectives have not been accomplished." That's like his ending mission to the people that were going out on the queue. This message that he made became viral. So fast forward, I think a year later, the guy stages another coup. I can't remember if he was still in jail or he had gotten released. But the guy stages another coup, okay? And the other coup fails again, okay? But by now, this guy is like, you know, he can move pieces. So like this guy is now becoming a bit of a force. He's like, people are coming to him. People, like, he's inspiring other people, you know? He's like, he's not letting down. People are like looking at this guy like, you know, that guy, you know, like, take it to the man, you know? Like, we want to support this guy. And so he's building up his building up and building up and building up. So he's got two failed coup attempts, guys in jail, and countries again and a lot of disarray. And at the time, the president was Rafael Caldera, and this guy thinks is a good idea. Basically, I believe it went down a little bit like this guy pinned him from jail and said, listen, I'm either going to stage a coup that is going to take you down, or I'm going to take you down through elections. And you're going to basically get me out of here. Like, give me a pardon so we can go toe-to-toe on elections, or I'm going to throw you down on a military, you know, showdown. And it's like, no problem. Cue the pardon. Chavez comes out. Chavez gets out. What do you think the first thing he does is, Cedric?
I'm guessing a military throwdown.
No. Gets on a plane, goes to Cuba. To get his training, my man. And that's when he start, that's when things start getting real. Like, real. So he flies back down and he's now running for president. And he's running for president. And at first, it's actually kind of similar to Trump in some ways, in that he didn't have a platform. He wasn't like a Democrat or a Republican or the Venezuelan equivalent at the time. He was not a politician. And so he comes and starts talking and starts yapping. He creates his own little party. And then some smaller political parties are like, maybe this guy does fit in our platform. And they're like, here, we'll tack on to your thing. And then we'll tack on to your thing. And we'll tack on to your thing. So he starts kind of collecting this like, mosaic of left out little parties, like the Communist Party, the this party, the that party, the Green Party. Like, he starts like collecting a lot of these little parties, and his party, you know, is growing and growing in popularity. So lo and behold, the guy, like, you know, what also didn't play in the favor of the politicians is that the other parties didn't think too much of him. They split the vote, basically. You know, they there were two people going up against Chavez. They didn't realize he was going to get so big. So the guy eked out a win, and then the rest is history. Because then he wins, and then it's like, you know, for the first time, people were looking at the TV, people in like remote rural parts of Venezuela were looking at TV, and they were being spoken to, right? This guy was saying, it's like, I know there are no schools in those farms.
Right.
I know there are, because I've been to those farms. Right. And like, people would look at him and be like, wow, like, he did grow up in Apure, because he did come from Apure. Right. None of these other politicians that were getting up there and saying, oh, I want to help you build that school in that farm. What could they relate to? So people were looking at that and saying, this guy gets it. He's going to come do it for us. Right. And so everybody wanted to like empower him and get behind him. And I'll tell you this, the guy was charismatic as anyone I have ever heard speak. He was so eloquent. I mean, this guy was able to get you to, you know, he was just so smooth. And so smart. Like, I'll give him that, you know. I wish he would have used his smarts for the better, but you can't deny that the guy was, you know, a very smart guy, very well-spoken guy, very convincing guy. And basically, when the red flags started popping up, was then he says, oh, well, I'm gonna rewrite the Constitution. The Constitution's unfair. Mm. And it's like, whoa, you know, this guy's going to rewrite the Constitution. And then he starts getting some pushback, and then things start getting really contentious, where eventually, and it started as this process, you know, there was like a veneer of democracy at the beginning, where he was like, well, no, this is how I want it. And sure, I listen, but okay. But then slowly but surely, he started stripping, you know, little layers away from democracy, like you know, the oil company, the PDVSA, he basically fired everybody, staffed it with his friends, finished taking over whatever it is that wasn't nationalized at the time. A lot of it was, he didn't actually come up with the idea of nationalizing oil. He just did a crappier job, nationalized the telecom company, nationalized a bunch of privates, anywhere from chicken producers to cattle to, you know, you name it, the guy took it over. So yeah, and then you know, as fate would have it, you know, as he's doing all these things, oil prices are booming. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the feedback loop for the society, the Venezuelan society, is then at that point it just gets broken. Like if it was broken before, it just gets thrown for a loop, because now they're seeing this guy like expropriate things on TV. And I wish I can overlay the clip to this conversation where he's like walking over and literally on you know, national TV, he points out a building and he goes, "That's where Simón Bolívar, you know, went to school. What's in there now?" It's like, "Oh, it's a commercial shopping center," blah, 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 like expropriated. And everybody's like, "Ah!" Like expropriated, build right. A school for no, 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 no. People are like, "Ah!" And it's like, and so of course, you know, yeah, as you saw this happen, and then you know, you're watching this go down, and you're watching this guy like take over. You know, for example, beef prices start going up, and people start complaining beef prices are going up, and so the guy goes, "Bring me, you know, the top cattle farmers and all the butchers, like bring them all, put them in the room. I want to talk to them." And like, "Yeah, Mr. President, you know, we're here because, you know, the feed they bring in, you know, the feed that we have to bring in is imported, and, you know, we have to bring it in. And some of the antibiotics that we have to bring in are also imported. So like, you know, we can't really make this work for less than X a pound." And he goes, "I'll show you how to do it. You know, if you don't know how to do it, give me the farm, I'll do it." And they're like, "Well, I don't want to give you the farm." and he's like, "Oh, you don't want to give me your farm? No problem." He goes, "Felipe, you know, the minister of whatever the hell, he's like, call my friends from Argentina, like fly down all their AAA stock beef, like, you know, put it in the shelves at X a pound." Because he has all this oil money.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you know, the guy's expropriating beef farmers and you're getting, you know, imported beef at half the price. And all of a sudden you're eating things you never had before at like a quarter of what it's worth, or many times less than that. Yeah. Anyway, I get carried away on these.
It's really interesting how, you know, he's playing with the fungibility of money and arbitraging, you know, the funds he has to dispose and acquire, you know, imported goods and then offer them at discounted prices to win over and woo the people in the short term. The Cuba point, I don't know if I had heard of that, but maybe invite in. It's still amazing. It's so fascinating to me how, you know, a leader like Chavez, I use the word leader maybe in quotes there, but someone who rises to power like Chavez from, you know, outside the system, then goes to Cuba, gets training. I don't know what kind of training that is in Cuba. It seems like, you know, because Cuba has effectively, you know, taken over, the regime has taken over a country and then held it for many decades. But they probably gave some old hand knowledge on how to take over the country or run for office or campaign. But then Chavez does it and then holds and is even able to transfer power, it seems like, to, a faction that's within the family. You know,
if I take a step back and listen to myself speak, I'm probably making these guys sound like evil geniuses, but in many ways, they were very brilliant. Like the Cuban G2, the Cuban intelligence service, is renowned for being brilliant. And I'll tell you, like people got mad when people were saying, "Oh, you know, the Russians are messing up with Facebook on the 2016 election on the this or the that." Dude, Chavez was doing this like
right.
2002. Right. I was like, I remember banging my head against my keyboard. I was like, how? You would open up Twitter and it was like all the trending topics were like, "I love Chavez. God bless socialism." And I'm like, these are not the trending topics in this country right now. But it was it. Those guys were in there eons before a lot any of this stuff became, you know, even discussed. I at the time I remember screaming, I was like, "Is there anybody analyzing bots in politics outside of like," because Twitter was a it's a big anyways it was a relatively big circle, and this was as recent as like 2013, 2014. Like these guys were very active on bots.
Yep.
But anyway.
It was
crazy. And listen, the trip, I think the trip wasn't like, it wasn't like the guy went and got like, Rocky type training where he was like, spent 3 months. I think it was like a short lived trip, but the point is he was very, very close to Fidel, very, very close to Fidel. Right. The playbook that they use in many ways, they use many of the playbooks that the Cubans had. Mm-hmm. For example, one of the things that they did was this thing called Barrio Adentro, which is one of the staple Chavez programs. And what it did is Barrio Adentro created this little container shaped clinics. And they were like this, a little container that you could drop into a remote area and it would like cure, it would treat you, because obviously a lot of these people live in remote. Like if you look at a favela, right? Like if you look at the architecture of a favela and you're the person that lives at the kind of top of the favela and you're sick, your only way down is like 450 steps that are slippery, and if it's raining, so like their favelas aren't really built for medicine or access. And so what he did is he started like plopping these little containers in these favelas, but there was a catch. The catch was that these things were all staffed with Cuban doctors, and anytime you went in and you got treated, they were like, the revolution treated you, the revolution cured you. It was the revolution that did this. It was the revolution, the revolution, the revolution, the revolution, the revolution. Right. And of course, come election time, what has the revolution done for you? What do you think is going to happen if the revolution goes away? Are you going to be able to get treated? Are you going to be able to get your home? Are you going to be able to continue getting your food?
Right.
Like, so that's the conditioning. They were masters of conditioning.
And so that
was one of the big things, I think, in my humble opinion.
I can only imagine. I do think there's only a handful of people in the world who've had these experiences of overtaking a nation and controlling people, or maybe it's dozens of people in the world. And I don't think it's like a handbook that they get, like a stack of papers and manuals. It's a quick conversation about a way to look at things and a way to turn things in your favor, or a little bit of that. But it's amazing when people can actually, for good, in a lot of cases for evil, it's still to stand back and observe. It's just a spectacle. And it's amazing to see someone hold the country under their thumb. It's unfortunate as all being. I'm curious, what were some of the signs that you might have saw, maybe during when this was happening, that really kind of like signaled to you things were really different than just someone gaining power or lying or using populism?
I can pin it back to, like, to me, the most defining red flag was the changing of the constitution. That anyone that thinks that they are in the right to fully revamp the entire agreement through which society is meant to govern itself, you need to check whoever that person is, right? Like, I don't know how many times in history that has happened, but I would argue that there's probably a pretty strong correlation between changes in the constitution and, like, authoritarian regimes, probably to the tune of like 1 to 1. But I don't know what the R coefficient is on that one, but it's pretty damn high, I probably guess.
Yeah. So when did you come across Bitcoin? You're moving from Venezuela to Miami to Venezuela, back to Miami and Toronto.
So I'm in Toronto. I'm in Toronto at the time, but as I mentioned, my whole family is back in Venezuela. So I guess, To continue to fill up, I guess, a few of the gaps, I guess, in the story is I have two younger brothers. My dad is an incredibly entrepreneurial guy. Like, I've seen him do so many things, and he's a huge inspiration of mine. But anyway, so we're three brothers, and every time, my dad wanted us, every time we graduated or finished university, whatever, my dad would encourage us to try to, take our swing at a bat, try to do something. And so I had done my swing, my brother had his swing, and now it's time for my youngest brother to do his thing. And this is in the middle of, so this is 2013, 2013 or 2014. So Chavez dies in 2013. So I think it's like right around the time Chavez dies. And actually, no, it was actually just after, because Chavez dies. We have this, there's this huge excitement in Venezuela just because there's this new election, because obviously we need to elect a new president. And everybody's like, okay, now with this guy gone, finally we're back to democracy. But that was not the case. The Communist Party at that point, and that's when they really leaned on Cuba. But at that point, they're able to kind of like, the Communist Party is able to like keep control, sans Chavez, right, of Venezuela, which was a huge thing for them. That was a defining moment too. Mm-hmm. And so when that happens, when the Communist Party wins the election without Chavez, I was just like, oh, okay, like, complete write-off. Like, this, now we're like done, you know, like this is done. And so my youngest brother, who had just finished school, was not in that camp. He wanted to stay. Mm-hmm. Badly. He's like, nope, not gonna leave, f these guys, you know, gotta get them out of here, you know, I'm gonna build my life. And we're like, great, no, like, you know, I was, you know, we wanted to support him, but in some ways I was like, there are times where the best thing you can do for your family is to exit the system, because it's a system that is not meant to be fairly challenged. The people that try to challenge the system through democratic means are literally all in jail and dead, like literally. So it's not a system that you want to like, you know, oh yay, I wanted to go run an election against you. Oh, you know, you're going to wake up one day, you know, swimming with the fishes. And so it's not easy to be a politician. And so anyway, he was really desperately trying to do something in Venezuela. He was sending my dad these business propositions. My brother and I were the analysts, and we were just kind of like, oh my God, no, this is crazy. Why are you going to invest in this facility there? And so, one of his pitches, as he's getting like increasingly frustrated towards the end, one of his pitches is like, okay, this is what I'm doing. If you guys don't like this, I'm done listening to you. I'm like leaving the house. So he's like, I want to mine this thing called Bitcoin. And he's like, they got to buy these computers. Like, this is what this is about. And so my dad's like, what the hell is this thing? So he calls me. He's like, okay, you're the finance guy. Read this thing, the white paper, sends me the Bitmain link, machines he wanted to buy. So I started looking into Bitcoin, looking at the mining, how, you know, read the white paper. And I'm like, okay, so the miners are essentially like the, you know, the gatekeepers, not the gatekeepers, but like the bouncers at the club, you know, and they're like protecting the network. And we're really always going to need miners. They're like an integral part of this, and they need a lot of power. Power is cheap and it's free. This thing has a market in a different country, like check. So I'm like, okay, like, you know, subsidized input, check, you know, global market, yeah. Check. I'm like, seems better than the other stuff. So like, sure. And so he goes and buys his first machines. At this point, I'm in Canada and didn't really think that much of it after that. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, great. Mario's going. So I fly back. I think it was at Christmas. It was like 6 months after. It was quite some time after. And the guy has like double the machines. Like if I remember his business plan, if the business plan had been like 5 machines, he's got like 10 machines. So I'm like, whoa, I'm like, where'd you get these machines? So I went to my dad, who like had a history of overfunding, you know, mm-hmm. We got excited. So I'm like, dad, what happened? You just give him more money. And he's like, no, pay me back. Those are his new machines. And I'm like, cool. Okay. So I went back to Mario. I'm like, Mario, like, you know, what is it that you have been really doing? You know, show me how you're making this money. And he's like, no, he starts telling me, you know, me mining, I'm doing this, you know, I got these. You know, I got this pool that I'm going into and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, great. I'm like, how are you turning these things into money? He's like, let me show you. And he uses this exchange that was working at the time in Minnesota called Sir Bitcoin. I still remember. And he sends the Bitcoin to Sir Bitcoin, does the trade, withdraws to his Banesco bank account. Banesco is like one of the big banks in Venezuela. Money hits the bank, like literally within an hour. And at that point, when that money hit that bank account, that was when I just like, to me, that was like the cosmic moment where I was just like, poof, like all the lights went off. And I was like, I need to do this for a living. And so I, at that point, it was just like, the gradual capitulation of everything else that I was doing in my life. I was like winding down everything else and just went full into Bitcoin from that point.
Yeah, I'm fascinated. I have a background in finance. And, you know, a lot of what you're doing, I love what you're doing at Ledin. And I see a lot of like what the tropes or the best traits of what a lot of us were trying to get out of microfinance a decade or two ago. And I'm kind of curious, is your brother still mining in Venezuela? Is that operation still going?
No, man. Mining in Venezuela is a very treacherous environment. So we didn't have the nicest experience there to end things. You know, we can get into it, but essentially, you know, one of my brother's facility was unjustly, unfairly raided. They took his machines. They tried to make a big fuss out of it. You know, we've since obviously sorted all that out. They got a full sort of pardon to whatever else happened to my brother. It's like
But you have to make a getaway out of the country at the time.
We did. Yeah, we did. We had to, you know, we had to help him. I actually paid for his hotel in Colombia that night with my credit card.
Your Canadian credit card.
Yeah, with my Canadian
credit card. I think that's really key to that story.
Yeah. Because we didn't want, and you know, a couple of the other pieces that there's one crossing in the Venezuelan Colombian border that has no internet connectivity. So it typically is the last crossing that essentially finds out about, you know, anything, any prohibitions, any things like any restrictions or anything. So that was the one that they like strategically ended up choosing, even though, you know, thankfully nothing was on, but just like out of a precaution. But it was a really treacherous experience. It was really dangerous. Like, I don't, you know, it sounds, you know, rolls out of your lips when you're saying it, but like crossing Venezuela by car at night is a very risky thing to do. And having to do that, like if you do that is because your other option is even more dire. So it's a very, very scary thing to go through. And it's really those times that make you think like nothing is worth this. You know, some people say, you know, sometimes I say to my friends that are still down there, I'll say things like, you know, hey, you know, why don't you, you know, have you ever considered coming to Canada? Have you ever considered, you know, moving to the US, moving to Spain, you know, going out for your kids, you know, for your family, for your this? And sometimes I'll get answers like, you know, hey, you know, things here are not too bad. You know, things here are great. You know, I can get my daughter's school costs, you know, $10 and I pay nothing for hydro and I pay nothing for my internet and I pay nothing for my cell phone. And I'm like, those are great, man. But, you know, the system, it's very high risk, high reward. No, I mean, I don't really know what the high reward is at this point, right. But it's very high risk. And to my point, it's a very low reward now.
It's got to be a hard reconciliation. I mean, you guys have come and gone from Venezuela a few times. Some have been at almost dire costs. And I can't imagine the danger involved there. And I could imagine at some moments, maybe someone in the family being like, fuck this Bitcoin thing. I mean, none of this is worth this kind of danger. And I know that it wasn't Bitcoin that put your brother in danger. It was the government. But I could see how some people might see the correlation, not the causation. And I'm kind of curious. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No, I was going to say, like, actually, I would think it's quite the opposite. I think Bitcoin is what Bitcoin gave us a reason to escape. Bitcoin gave us an industry where, because of a necessity, we had a head start. And I think I wouldn't change that for the world, because I probably wouldn't be here if that hadn't happened. I wouldn't be here if the only business that made sense for my brother back in 2014 or 2013, whatever the hell the document he said was, that was the only thing that made sense because the country was so broken. And you know, there were many reasons that made Venezuelans. And actually, if you look around the crypto industry, you'll see a lot of Venezuelans. There's a lot of us out there. And I'm actually that's something that I think makes us really proud. And you know, you'll see us at a conference, we'll all be hugging each other and, like, you know, chatting about, you know, particular, you know, just you know, shooting the shit about back home and what we can do to make it better. But there's a lot of us in the space. And that's actually one of the funnest things about my job is to get to deal with other Venezuelans or people in Latam in general.
Yeah. Yeah. Venezuela is a really fascinating country. And I've had Javier Bastardo on the show.
Nice.
And that was a fantastic conversation. And it really, you know, there's so much more to cover in Venezuela. And it might come up as we go into this, but I do want to turn more to Bitcoin. But I think it's obvious how, you know, you've been primed for seeing, you know, or not seeing Bitcoin, but dealing with currency and dealing with risk and capital controls. But I do want to talk about Bitcoin as credit and savings financial instruments, and sort of your take on Bitcoin savings and credit.
Yeah, so I guess I'll give you my two cents of this mechanic of what I see a Bitcoin-backed loan as. The original underpinning on this is a very simple concept: is borrow a weak currency or borrow a weak asset and invest that money in a hard asset. It's a very simple exercise. And to me, the clearest example that most people can relate to is a mortgage in a property on a home, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like, to buy a property, you take a ginormous loan to buy a house, right? And you do that because your house takes a long time to build. And typically speaking, you don't build a house at the same speed at which, you know, they print the money. So I guess what the mechanic here is that you are taking something that, you know, you're borrowing in an asset that, you know, is by definition designed to become weaker over time. That is what fiat is. If you want basically really kind of go into like the mechanics of money, it's a monetary base that continues to get inflated over time. Like, there's only going to be more money out there. Like, there's never less money out there. Like, the government doesn't destroy money. Like, they don't take it in, right? They just pump more money into the system. And so you're borrowing in an asset that is designed to inflate, and you're investing it in an asset that is very, very hard to inflate the supply of, right? Like a property, okay? In the American context, for people growing up and seeing this activity, American people growing up probably saw many of their neighbors and their family and their relatives become very wealthy by having a lot of property. That is probably the case, okay? Similarly, in places like Venezuela, many people like myself saw many others become very wealthy by having also property. But the more common trade in Venezuela was to borrow from the bank in bolivares and buy dollars. Mm-hmm. And you could borrow bolivares at a rate of, say, 10% when the inflation rate for the dollar was 120%. Mm. So you would literally borrow it, buy the dollars on day one, you wait a year for inflation to do its thing, you sell a fraction of the dollars, you repay the line of credit with the bank, and you do it all over again. And what this is shorting the bolivar, long dollar. You know, right. if you model this out, you are short the bolivar, right, by way of the dollar. To me, that was a winning trade my whole life. Like, I saw people build wealth in all countries. And, you know, if you translate that trade into a mortgage or into a bolivar short, you know, by borrowing bolivares and buying dollars, it's always borrowing an asset that is designed to become weaker at a rate that is very low and shouldn't probably be that low. And you're buying it in an asset that is very hard to inflate the supply of. And therefore the price of that asset and denominated in the same asset that you borrow to buy it will likely go up over time, right? That is just the function of the two pieces of that puzzle, right? So when I saw my brother start building his first few mines and I started building my first few mines and I started helping others build their first few mines in Bitcoin, there was a very big problem, which was that the only way to buy more equipment and to get more financing was to sell that Bitcoin that you had originally to start with. Mm-hmm. And because it was rising at such a high pace, the opportunity cost of selling that Bitcoin over the course of a year was just was in like the thousands of percent, you know? And so, you know, you would have paid anything essentially to not have to sell the Bitcoin and to get financing for that Bitcoin.
Right.
And we, you know, that problem was evident in the first few, but there were so many opportunities in terms, you know, as a Venezuelan kid building a few mines, you know, and helping people and just getting into this Bitcoin space. Like I wasn't really at the time thinking that, you know, we could, you know, pull a world-class team together to build this. But as I started helping more and more people, and as I started transacting more and more and spending more time in Bitcoin, you know, I actually spent, I think it was like 2 or 3 years where I was just like mining and researching full time and helping people do this. And so basically when we start building our mine in Canada, Adam and I are like, you know, this mining was exciting, but you know, at the 2017 stage, you know, right around that time, you're starting to see all these random companies go public. And it was just like anything that had blockchain in it. It was at the time where, you know, you had like Long Island Iced Tea and you know, that kind of stuff where everybody was just throwing blockchain on their, right, on their stock tickers and stuff. And when we found the same issue in the financing issue we had in their mind in Canada, we were just like, we are the right people to solve this problem because we understand this problem better than anyone else. And, or I think, you know, we understand it pretty well.
Yeah.
And we knew, you know, we know what we as a client would need and we can build as a client would. Yeah. And I think that actually comes across in our product. And I think when you compare our offering, you know, relative to other places where you could potentially get similar services, the experience is different. The way the experience is designed is different. Like the things we prioritize are different. Mm-hmm. Like if you look at, for example, when the prices are dropping, you know, some other companies might, you know, roll out tweets and things about, you know, buy the dip or do the this or do the that.
Right.
And like, we'll try to prioritize things on like, check your LTVs. Like when was the last time you checked where your loan LTV was?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
Please go check it. Like we don't like,
text your, you know, users, yeah.
Our UI try, you know, in our UI, we try to like light up the path whenever there's a requirement for a top up. It's like lit up in red. It's like, please do top this up. Like, you know, we try to be, you know, borderline, obsessive about trying to remind our clients, but obviously people come to us because they don't want to sell their Bitcoin. So like to us, it's a really big deal. It's a reality of our business, but we want people to go into it, you know, eyes wide open. That's part of understanding the rules so you can get a great experience. Otherwise, you know, if you don't have a great experience, you're not coming back.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I find you guys are definitely doing all that. I mean, you guys are putting language or using the language of your users in as many places as you can. You're having the customer service in the language of your users, which is very important. I find this finance stuff probably even more exciting than the mining stuff. Even from, you know, and it's hard for me to reconcile it in the Bitcoin world, but I do come from the traditional legacy finance world. So I find the financial products very interesting, not so much the DeFi stuff. I think that's all going to happen on Bitcoin, but so I find that interesting, just, you know, in a different sort of format. But what I think is really interesting about the finance side here is that you're making certain things global when they've only been local. So, you know, historically,
if you're in Venezuela, you can only borrow in bolivars. Maybe you could sell for dollars or Bitcoin, but you're only going to a Venezuelan bank. You're getting your car loan in bolivars, or whatever the local bank is offering. Maybe it's dollars, but and now you can interact with a Canadian company and get Canadian, property assurances alongside your Bitcoin. And you might have, I think, very different needs than legacy traditional finance users. But I do think that in a weird way, North American traditional legacy users or North American Bitcoiners are kind of catching up to some of these needs that are in Latin America. Like I think that people don't want to sell their Bitcoin and they want to find a way to get out of Bitcoin without having a tax transaction. So not selling their Bitcoin, I don't mean get out of it, but not selling it, but being able to collateralize that, and get dollars or whatever the currency they want to get, and not necessarily deal with a local institution, which I think is very interesting there. So, what I'd love to talk about is, you guys do offer the highest rates in the industry. It's 9% on the USDC. And I think it's 6.1 on the Bitcoin, up to 2 Bitcoin. So how do you guys go about providing the highest rates? I hope you guys are enjoying this conversation with Maurizio as much as I am. Before we get back into it, I want to share with you some information about Bitcoin 2022. Among the speakers announced for the general conference on April 7th to 8th are Elizabeth Stark, CEO and co-founder of Lightning Labs, MicroStrategy Chairman and CEO Michael Saylor, Adam Beck, CEO and co-founder of Blockstream, venture capitalist Elise Killeen, and former presidential candidate and now New York City mayoral candidate Andrew Yang. More speakers will be announced shortly. Bitcoin 2021 drew a record attendance of 12,000 to Mana Wynwood in early June, bringing together founders, C-suite executives, Bitcoin experts, and newcomers for discussions, networking events, and live performances. Jack Dorsey's keynote talk was a highlight, as well as the emotional closing announcement from Jack Mallers that El Salvador was moving to make Bitcoin legal tender. For 2022, the conference has been expanded and will include a fourth day for a Sound Money Fest music festival. The Miami Beach Convention Center will provide 5 times the space, and organizers are expecting more than 30,000 attendees. Bitcoin 2022 conference, which celebrates Bitcoin over 4 days, April 6th through 9th next year, with 4 different passes. The 4 days include Industry Day, 2 days of main events and speakers, and lastly, a festival day, which is a day of music and networking. Prices will continue to rise over the next few months, so get in early and use my affiliate code for 10% off your tickets. Last year, I got to meet so many Bitcoiners that I got to meet originally through the Bitcoin Matrix podcast or just shitposting on Twitter. Bitcoiners were everywhere, the hotel lobby, at the parties, at the beach, and I'm just so excited to get back to Miami and to see everybody again and meet even more fresh and dope Bitcoiners in the Bitcoin overlay. So go to TIXR.com/PR/Cedric2022/26217 and remember to use the code Cedric2022 and get 10% off your tickets to Bitcoin 2022. You're not going to want to miss this incredible event. And now, let's re-enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Maurizio, where we get into Bitcoin savings, credit, collateralized loans, and how Ledin provides the highest interest rates in the industry.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think something that people need to, one of the things I think is important in this space for this industry to mature is not all companies operate in the same way and not everybody does the same things to get things, you know, to get interest back paid out to their clients. And that's something we'd like to be really upfront about as far as like what it is that we do, like what the risks are, like what we do to protect those risks, and just be very transparent about, you know, what we do, because I think people want to understand where their money's going. And so there's two, you know, obviously, you know, we're in the business of borrowing and lending, right? So we borrow at one rate, we lend at another. The difference between the two rates is called the spread. And that's the business that we're in, right? Like we source capital from one source and we deploy it in another source. That's the name of our game. So if you look at, you know, to kind of paint a picture on the product that most people will see the headline rates for, which is actually quite simple to understand, is our USDC savings account and our Bitcoin-backed loans. So USDCs, you know, we can use our USDC, you can think of the funds that come to our USDC savings accounts as the dollars that we use to fund our Bitcoin-backed loans, okay? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the rate that we pay on the savings account for USDC, it's 9% interest, right? APY. If you go into an APR basis, I believe the simple rate is like 8.84 or something along those lines. So if you look at our loan product has an interest rate of 9.5% and an admin rate of 2%. And so that is an all-in rate of 11.5%, right? That is our spread. You know, we borrow at 9, we lend at 11.5, and the difference is what we make, right? That is the biggest driver of the rate that we pay our savings clients on the USDC side is the book of loan originations that we have on people that don't want to sell their Bitcoin, right? And you might think, you know, some people might ask, you know, why would you borrow to not sell your Bitcoin at, you know, at a rate, you know, at like a 9% rate? Like who would borrow at 9% rate? Like the opportunity cost of, so I guess a couple of things. There's many reasons why somebody would borrow, but I'll go through the sort of higher picture ones. If you are a North American person that has a substantial built-in profit on your Bitcoin position, if you were a guy that bought Bitcoin at 5K, 10K, and you're sitting on, you know, God knows what percentage of built-up profit on that Bitcoin, when you sell that Bitcoin, you're going to create a large taxable event for yourself. To the tune of, you know, maybe even 25%, 30% of the whole value of the sale, if that's your cup of tea. Alternatively, you could take a loan on that Bitcoin, which is not a taxable event. Mm-hmm. And you can essentially then, if you reinvest, in some cases, please consult your tax account. Like I'm not a tax, this is not tax advice, but in many cases, you can actually, that the interest rate that you pay for this loan can be tax deductible as well. Mm. So it is a great tax optimization tool for investors in wealthy markets. There's another subset of clients that love this product because our B2X product, it basically gives you a loan and the equivalent amount of the Bitcoin that you have to double the Bitcoin that you own. So if you are of the view that Bitcoin could go up in price by more than 9 or 11% over the course of the next year, then potentially this product can make sense for you. And it's actually our most popular product.
I love this product. Yeah.
And it's a one-year term. You don't really have to worry about it getting your interest rate changing on you or anything.
And you don't pay any payments, I think, until.
And you don't pay monthly payments until you close the loan. So it's really like it's.
And you can pay back with no pre-penalty.
You can pay it back at any time and you can pay it back with cash. And if you do that, you never create a taxable event on that additional Bitcoin that you bought. So there's a lot of reasons why people love this B2X product. But going back to the savings account, the biggest driver for us to pay the interest rate on the dollars is, or on the USDC, is the amount of loans that we originate on our Bitcoin-backed loan side. And so, of course, we can adjust those as needed. So like if we have way more dollars than we have going into our loans and we have to then go into other opportunities that perhaps don't have the same returns, then we have to bring down the blended rate for everything down. And then similarly on the Bitcoin side, you know, when we get Bitcoin that people bring onto the platform, we lend it to Genesis or our select institutional counterparties that we work very diligently to, you know, analyze the risk and get comfortable with. And it's a very small subset that we open up very, very carefully. But with those companies, That's how we lend that Bitcoin, and the interest that we get paid from them, we then turn around and pay it to our clients. And then transparent, and I like to also be very candid about this too. You know, on the when you look at the savings account, like people love earning interest under Bitcoin, right? And it's great for us. It's a great way for us to get people to try the platform, to come on and to experience it, to make a deposit, make a withdrawal, see how things work, check the support, check our response times, you know, test the system, and then they'll come for a loan. Or then they'll come in and they'll stick around. They'll do a B2X. And so for us, we use the savings account almost as like an introductory product. And I also think that it's important that people know, like, the dynamics of interest rates, you know, a lot of these things you can go and look at the markets. So like the first tier of the savings account that ourselves have and like other platforms have is typically essentially a marketing effort for people to come test the platform. I think when people look at what is the actual market, like if you wanted to bring 500 Bitcoin to earn interest, your rate is not going to be that introductory first tier rate. Your rate's going to be much lower. And because if you look at what the rates are, once you go north of two Bitcoin, north of one Bitcoin in most platforms, the rates drop off a cliff. They go to like 2%, 1%, 50 basis points, right? Because that's what you can deploy Bitcoin on at size, right? Like companies still manage to provide a great introductory rate for the first little bit of Bitcoin that people bring onto the platform. And many times that's used as an introductory, hey, come get, you know, come interact with us, check us out, check out our other products as well. But it's important that people know that for the business to be sustainable, you know, higher rates, all I'm trying to say is like, they're not always the greatest thing, right? Like you should actually check that the company is doing things that are sustainable. And if they have a great rate, are they upfront about it? Mm-hmm. Like, do they understand, like, are they transparent that that's what it is? And they're not just like kind of like dismissing your comment. And it's like, no, just come, right? Like, I think these things are very important that everybody kind of goes into it eyes wide open. Because, you know, we strive to be the most efficient and we strive to pay the best rates, but we know that the business has to remain sustainable. You know, we are not in this for a year. We are not in this for a night. Like, these are our careers. These are our lives. Like, we, you know, I can't think of my life, like professional life beyond that. And I don't want to right now. So we do things as if, you know, we do things as if we want to be here forever, right? And we want everybody to kind of, to the extent that we can, we want to bring everyone in on our thinking and how we assess risk, how we think about risk, and what we do to you know, to keep their money in the best hands possible and like earning the best rates, but always with like a huge consideration for the risk that is being undertaken to get there.
Yeah, I think that's very important. I think that it's amazing what you guys are striving to do. I also think it's very, you know, very relevant to note that there are different kinds of users. So kind of before I was touching on how, you know, I think of myself as a hardcore Bitcoin maxi. And I'm like, I would never lend my Bitcoin, maybe that kind of thing. And I've had to really kind of do a 180 on that. And recognize, one, there are people that are coming from a very different place than I am, like maybe users in Latin America who only have $100 in savings or $200 in savings. And so, A, maybe they don't want to have all their savings in Bitcoin. And the volatility on a short-term basis is not the best thing for them. And that's why having 9% on USDC is a fantastic opportunity. Especially compared to anything you're getting, even at a North American bank. And, you know, I've come along. Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, you know, to your point, like, I actually think of the USDC savings account as almost like a gateway drug to Bitcoin. Because, you know, listen, like, people outside of the United States and investor markets, they want dollar banking. Like, if you polled 100 people in Nigeria, And I, as Bitcoiners, I think we need to acknowledge this, right? Like, and we need to understand this because it'll teach us what are the things we can do better as far as the experience and where Bitcoin needs to be, or how we can complement the experience to bridge people and get them there, right? But if you pull most people in emerging markets, like the underbanked, like everybody talks about, oh, I want to bank the unbanked. Okay, go pull the unbanked and offer them a mobile wallet that deals in US dollars versus a mobile wallet that deals in Bitcoin. Okay, and ask them and see what they pick. And I will guarantee you that 99% of the people will be like, dollar, great. What, please, I'm in, sign me up. You know, and people really want to, listen, many people here are like, not here, many people in like the hardcore Bitcoin camp, like there's a lot of like anti-dollar, anti-demand, you know, screw the Fed, you know, and the Fed, this kind of stuff. The dollar is like the beacon of freedom as far as currencies go in the world. And so like people like worship the dollar. I don't really know how to express this. Like outside of America, the love and respect people have for the US dollar is something that I actually have never come across. And so, you know, this to somebody that, you know, if I tell somebody, hey, you know, Miguel, you know, listen, come try this, you know, this, you know, I can give you Bitcoin, you can earn interest on this, but Bitcoin, I don't really understand it. Do you understand dollars? Mm-hmm. Do you want interest in dollars? Okay, USC, here, come, mm-hmm. check it in. And then a week
with
later,
a different he'll be countries, like, maybe property assurances.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then you'll say, okay, great. Then this stuff is not so scary. Oh, I can trade this and I can get a little bit of Bitcoin to try out. Oh, boom, I just made a one-click trade. I have some Bitcoin. And now you see the price going up, and it just, you know, to me, it's like people find their way to protect their own savings. You don't have to teach somebody once they see something going
up.
It's an A-B
test.
People just need to be informed. Yeah. Once they're aware that something's happening and how it's impacting them, they'll make their own decision for their best interest.
Yeah.
And so I'm actually, I fully believe in that, right? Like, there's abundance evidence. Like if you just empower somebody with the right knowledge, let them make the decision. There's obviously caveats here and exceptions with like the heavy programming and indoctrination. And there's like a lot of stuff that's really hard to overcome, but at a high level, if somebody wants to learn and you give them the right information, they can be empowered to make the right decision.
Empowerment. Yeah. And you know, I've just done a huge 180 though on, you know, these kind of lending programs, because I really love the Buy2X program, the mortgage for the Bitcoin you already own. I was kind of touching on it before where I struggle with the Bitcoin Maximi, but I know this is a foolish part of the Bitcoin Maximi, because I very much believe in these the mortgage for the Bitcoin you already own, in the sense that there'll be Bitcoin banks and it'll be much the way the rich and the wealthy use stocks to do secured personal loans versus selling the stock and incurring the transaction and losing the inflated asset, et cetera, et cetera. So I love that product. You've also, I think, just recently rolled out Lead in Trade.
We did, yeah. And we had a lot of people that, like I was saying, you know, they move around Bitcoin and USDC. They ebb and they flow. They don't want to, you know, they want to have a bit more of the other. And we had the two accounts on the platform. There was no option to trade around them or between them. So people, you know, when they wanted to move around, they had to leave the platform, book the trade elsewhere, come back. And obviously we know we want to, you know, we want people to be able to do as much on the platform as they can. If we can avoid giving them a reason to leave, obviously we want to build so that they can stay and you know, sort whatever they need on Ledin. And so we rolled out that trade feature. It's been actually growing quite fast. It's been surprising, actually, the popularity or seeing just how fast that USDC account has grown as well. You know, Bitcoin is still, you know, much bigger, but it's fascinating, and obviously, you know, people use it in small denominations in growth markets, but there's some big tickets going into USDC in investor markets. Like there's a lot of people that are coming in it with big tickets to, because they see, you know, we've been lending for 3 years, like 0% loan losses. Like it's, Bitcoin is actually better to finance than a house. We can sell it 24/7. If somebody partially defaults on a house, you can't sell like a room. And so it's the same with a car, right? And so they're waking up to how great of an asset class is this to finance. And I think one of the beautiful things about keeping Ledin so I guess boring from a you know, crypto standpoint, you know, two assets, no token, you know, it's like a compliant Canadian company, you know, in many ways for a long time, that was, you know, played against us in the sense that people wanted like the high flying token, the this, the that, the, you know, throw me the Dogecoin and the, you know, 100x perpetual futures on Doge. And, you know, we're not that shop, you know, but now people are sort of like coming back to the sort of elegance and simplicity. And they're saying, oh, wow, these guys are actually simple. Like, I feel safer because they don't have all this other bells and whistles and things. And trust me, it's a lot less to worry about. we focus on two great assets, and that's really our jam. And then we'll add great complementary services and complementary assets maybe in the future. But that's our core, is to be very simple, like to the point where almost it's considered boring in some circles of crypto, right?
Yeah. I can't even imagine running the business without the USDC. I think it's a very important in today's environment complement within your portal to work with things and to make things global, which I think is awesome. I really want to get at your proof of reserve attestation and the audit. And if you could kind of elaborate on what goes on there, because I think there's a lot of really benefits and assurances that come out of this program.
Yes. So that's something that we've been, you know, from day one, we've wanted to always respect this sort of don't trust, verify ethos, right, of Bitcoin. And I think that, you know, one of the beautiful things that Bitcoin did is that it got people in this mindset of self-verify, audit, check, like look at the data, look at the source, like read it, you know, like do your diligence. Don't just sit there and listen. And the people that take this and act on it, they do end up making more informed decisions, right? Like there's a lot of people that just like, you know, bang themselves to their chest, and then they won't do DD. They won't do read terms and conditions. They won't go ask anything. They'll just go send things to a platform, and that's fine too if they feel so convinced. But I think we never wanted to lose, or we wanted to do everything we could to maintain this don't trust, verify ethos, and to always give our clients the means, if we could, to feel or to check that we are in fact doing what we said we do, right? And that becomes challenging as the company grows and becomes more complex, and you add more products and services and savings accounts and lending, and things aren't on chain anymore. And so it's like you start having to keep track of a lot of things. Again, as you add more assets and as you add more products, all these exercises become exponentially more complicated. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's very difficult for you know, it's not that a lot of companies probably don't want to do these types of proof of reserve attestations, is that it's actually really difficult to get them out there and to get an accountant to say, yes, I'll put my name on it. Yes, I checked everything. And that's been the one of the beautiful things about this process. So what it is, it's a proof of reserve attestation. We do this every 6 months, and we do this with a certified public accountant, and it's called Armanino LLP. And what happens is every 6 months, Armanino comes in. They basically get an anonymized data set of all of our client balances, like of all of our account balances, like what we owe our clients, what we have on our clients' behalf. They then also get copies or access and ways to verify essentially what our balances are in our custody facility, what we have out into our lending parties, what we have in our trading venue. And essentially they add all of the assets, and they make sure that all the assets that we have match all the liabilities that we owe our clients. And obviously we have an excess of, assets to liabilities. And now there's a way of gaming this, right? There are ways of gaming this. And the way of the main way of gaming this is that we would go to the accountant and we would say, we don't have 20, you know, we don't have X billion dollars. We have $100,000, right? Like we would underrepresent our client balances. Mm. So what we do is we give, so when we anonymize the data set to give it to the accountant, mm-hmm. we create an anonymized identifier for each of our clients and each of their account balances that we gave the accountant at that time, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. That ID then gets exposed to our clients. That anonymized ID then gets given back to our clients. And they can then use that to go to the accountant's website and check that the balance at their, the balance in their account mm-hmm. was the balance we told the accountant that we had, right? Mm-hmm. And that ensures that we won't lie to the accountant, right? Because we are giving every single one of our clients the ability to say, hey, they did, you know, I did in fact have this, they did in fact owe me this much money, right? And so if that does not match, then you can, you know, freak out, make a decision, call us, like do whatever it is. But the obviously it matches to the Satoshi, which is, I cannot speak high enough of our operations and accounting team, but our balances match to the Satoshi and to the cent. And like I said, you know, we do this every 6 months. Every single client with a balance get these when they happen. Everyone's automatically included. And we're really proud of that. And you know, we were the first ones to do that. To my knowledge, in the way that we do it, we're still the only ones. And we want to continue doing that. You know, hopefully, we're very transparent and open about how this process works. If you know, and we're very open if anybody wants to talk to us about how to do this. We actually host spaces and stuff. We brought the guys over from BitMEX. They do a really cool proof of reserves concept. We brought over the guys from Blockstream to talk about their proof of reserves model. Like people have their different approaches to it.
Right.
But I think all approaches are good approaches if we're having this conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. And you wrote the article, Why Proof of Reserves is Important to Bitcoin. I remember reading that and that kind of put you on my radar. I'm kind of curious what it's like dealing with international fintech regulations.
That's you know, it's a fascinating question. So I guess the first one is lending, right? Like to talk about lending, I think, you know, I guess to break it down, products, different products are regulated in different ways. It's not, so for example, you know, I'll give you our trade product, our savings product and our loan product, right? Most jurisdictions internationally are actually very welcoming of foreign capital when you're lending, as long as it doesn't come in at predatory mm-hmm. rates. Mm-hmm. So like if you're lending to somebody in Colombia, if you're lending to somebody in Guatemala, if you're lending to somebody in Peru, there's generally no real restriction around that, other than consumer protection, of course. And around consumer protection is usually a clause around predatory lending, right? Like you don't want to, you know, get people, you know, hose people. Nobody wants their constituents to get taken advantage of. Like, for example, in Canada, the predatory lending rate is 60%. So like, you know, at 11%, our loans are like far, far away from, you know, anyone would consider predatory. So that's really never a concern or hasn't been a concern to date. And on that side of things, you know, like I said, it's pretty, it's really welcoming. When it comes to trade, you know, again, we don't have on-ramps yet at Ledin. So the fiat on-ramp is typically the most regulated piece when you look at foreign jurisdictions. And that's because most foreign jurisdictions really care about capital control mm-hmm. and protecting their exchange rate. And so the interaction with fiat, anytime you're touching fiat, is typically the one that tends to face the most regulation, right? Like, for example, if you look at the sandbox that is in Colombia right now, it's essentially just like a fiat on and off ramp sandbox, right? Like that's all that people in that sandbox can do. So in essence, that is the breakdown. In many cases, like for many of these countries, for some products, like in some products, there's a framework, right? For example, in the lending, in some products, there really isn't a framework yet, right? Like you fit the product into the particular buckets that may exist, but in many cases, there is no real framework to regulate digital asset transactions, right? So it's really market specific. And we have actually as many lawyers as we do developers, which is, you know, I didn't really think that I would be saying this, but it is something that is a reality of our business. So our legal team is yeah, full of rock stars as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm super curious. That's kind of funny with the lawyers. I'm kind of curious what you think of El Salvador and even the president.
Wow, those are two very different questions. listen, I'll give you my two cents on El Salvador. Actually, it's pretty near and dear to my heart because I've been actually pretty close with one of my friends that I grew up with who is in El Salvador, very involved in this movement, in this Bitcoin movement. So first, the move. I think, you know, with everything, you have to look at the incentives, right? Like, why is Bukele potentially doing this now? You know, there's an argument that, yes, this is for the benefit of its people. There's another argument that, you know, he just wants the international limelight. You know, I wanna separate the two for a second because we can get into Bukele after. I think base case, if we look at just the fact that Bitcoin became legal tender, I think this is a net positive for the world. And I think this is going to really put the IMF in a tight spot and put this whole idea of the dollar. Like there's a lot of these people, there's a lot of thoughts that people have had, like, oh, what happens if this? What happens if this company breaks from the SWIFT system? Oh my God, this company's gonna, because everybody's like, oh my God, like imagine getting disconnected from the SWIFT system. It's like your country would burn. It would be such a crash, right? And people have these like crazy wild thoughts. But it's like, what if it does get disconnected from the SWIFT system and nothing happens? Right. Like, what if it does connect it from the SWIFT system and like, we just send Bitcoin across and it works. And so, you know, as if you're the IMF and you're sitting on the other side of that argument, it's like, they have a lot more to lose. if you think about it, like if it crashes and burns, everybody's like, oh damn, you know, like nice try El Salvador, you know, you can go, you know, dust yourself off and try again, you know?
Yeah.
But if it works, it's just like the stakes are too high. They're just too high because it's going to be too tempting for like when people cite the reasons for not doing this, people are like, oh, why would you not adopt Bitcoin? It's like, well, why would you give up your right to seniorage? It's like, yeah, of course, but you don't have it. You're El Salvador. You use the dollar. You have no seniorage. The incentives for a country like El Salvador to me are quite clear. So I think it's an incredible experiment. And if it doesn't work now, it is bound to work eventually. And so I do think I hope and pray that it does work now. But I even think even if it doesn't, even if they for some reason are not able to get this off, it's a matter of time before it does work. So that's my two cents. On the other side, I do have to say, like, you know, while it's really empowering to be your own bank, not everybody wants or is prepared or is even better served by having access to their keys. Because I think, you know, we as Bitcoiners sometimes get carried away with this concept of like, yeah, everybody wants to be sovereign and like, you know, carve their keys into metal. It's like, you know, not everyone's like that, right? Like a lot of people want to have everything done for them. Their life, the whole lives are on autopilot. So I do think that we can't just blanket this. Everybody wants to be their own bank and is well served by doing this and throwing this responsibility on them. So, you know, in some ways, I think Chivo was the right choice in a custodial approach to it. I don't think, you know, that type of rollout that broadly is you know, best suited for success with no client support, with no one to call, like no rule set. That's a big reason of why we built Ledin the way we did and to get to those markets. Because we felt deeply that it would be needed. But I think, you know, again, on El Salvador and on Bitcoin becoming legal tender, I think it's great for the reasons I mentioned. You know. On Bukele personally, listen, I'll caveat this with, I'll say I'm not a historian from El Salvador. I would not consider myself a Bukele historian either. Mm-hmm. I'm going by headlines and conversations that I've had with people from El Salvador, and even conversations that I've had with people very close to the government of El Salvador, and like about this whole Bitcoin thing and how some of them are thinking about this. Again, caveat this with some of these governments that can be disconnected from what the top does. Sometimes those things can be very well intended, but you know, the top acts in a different direction. So I also don't want to, I want to be very sort of cautious here in how I'm framing this, but listen, I think it's challenging in the sense that he definitely has some authoritarian traits to him. He's got some things that he does that I look at and I'm just like, red flags. Like those to me are some red flags. The challenging part is that he's doing things that in some ways I think are positive for people in El Salvador, like this Bitcoin law, right? I think that's actually a net positive for the people of El Salvador. So it presents a challenge in that, hey, you want the guy to be empowered. You want the guy to do, you know, great things, but you don't want that to happen at the expense of the democratic process, right? And the problem is that I've seen this book before, right? Some guys will stand at that situation, will stand at that cliff, and they'll say, you know what? It's not worth it. I'm going to empower my right-hand person. He's ready for it. I'm going to launch him and he's going to have a campaign. And like, I want him to win. I'm not going to change the rules so that I can run again. I'm not going to do that.
Right.
I'm going to step aside and I'm going to let someone else do this, right? When you have to actually say to an entire country that you've come to the conclusion that the best choice is that you have to do it again, and that there's like really no one else that can come close to doing exactly what you just did, even if it's the same political party, even if it's you calling the shots in the background still, even if it's you, you know, doing everything else, but not you, that's a bit of a red flag to me, right? And like, especially because typically to do that, like the electoral terms are kind of weaved into the constitution for a reason, because they're made to be hard to change. And if somebody wants to change them, it's going to be this huge thing that everybody has to get involved and sign off on. So whenever I see that kind of come up in argument, like I was saying, rarely does it lead to good things. And so this guy is trying to change the constitution. So if I'm applying my own book and my own law, I need to raise the red flag on this, right? Yeah. So like I said, you know, do I think El Salvador has a better option right now? I don't know. This guy seems like he's got the momentum and he's got it going. And I don't really know what the opposite end of that spectrum would look like. But in fact, you know, if he hasn't been thoughtful thus far about empowering others within his party and making the movement bigger than just himself, check that guy. Right? Because the same was happening with Chavez, right? And it stops, the line gets blurred really quickly. And then at some point it stops being for Venezuela and it's for Chavez. And it's like, you know, for example, in Venezuela, they started referring to Chavez as like mi comandante, my commander, mi gigante, like my giant. And then after he passed away, they would call him things like mi comandante eterno. People will, they have eterno, altars to Chavez like there are people that like light up like
right.
photos of Chavez, right? And so it gets the line crosses really quickly. And so I'm seeing some of that. I have to say, you know.
Yeah, I really struggle with, you know, I'm not there. We're not there. I don't know what's going on the ground. I don't have skin in the game. I struggle with, you know, monarchy versus democracy and long-term thinking. He's a younger politician, so he can have take more chances. But I really don't know what's going on the ground. I do think the Bitcoin thing is a net positive. I can't help but think about, on a real different tangent, just the opportunity Libra and Facebook is missing out on, and sort of what they could have done with sort of just, I think they should have just backed the dollar. They should have just rolled out a digital dollar, and they could have infiltrated all these countries and dollarized them on behalf of the US. And we could debate whether that's, you know, colonialism and this, that, and the other. But I think that would have been an opportunity for Facebook, and maybe they could still do it. I'm kind of curious what you think about Libra and something like even the project Make or Die, because I think I bring this up because I think it's really important to have that. And I hate calling them stable coins. I don't think they should be called stable coins because it's redundant or it just doesn't make sense. They're not stable. They're just fiat coins. But I think they're important as on and off ramps for people in this digital world. So I don't think they should be disregarded.
No, I think, you know, I would probably echo that entirely. I think, you know, Libra, you know, the issue with Libra is that they tried to buy too much too soon, and they tried to do just, the plan was just too ambitious from day one. They needed to start, you know, local and, you know, go from there and not try to make this sort of massive thing that's going to freak out every central bank in the world. You know, of course, right? I think stablecoins are an absolutely revolutionary sort of development that we've unlocked in this crypto space. I think a lot of people underestimate how meaningful it is for somebody to be able to transfer value in a dollar format across the globe for free and not have to go through the SWIFT system. And even Venezuelan will tell you, so it doesn't matter what most of you do, you show up to a bank, you're a high risk individual. Right. I'm a Canadian, right? I have a nice Canadian passport and I have a nice Italian passport too. And so I've been kind of sheltered from some of this, but not entirely, and throughout my life. But I have been with enough friends that so I'll give you an example. One time we were trying to wire money from one of my dad's accounts into a clinic in Texas. I think it was the Anderson Clinic in Texas to pay for surgery, and the bank wouldn't let us transfer the money. It took us 10 days for the bank to transfer the money. I think the surgery, I can't remember if the surgery had to get delayed or not. I don't think so. I don't think it was that dramatic, but it was to the point where it almost did. And when it's your money, it's been sitting in that bank for years, waiting for the moment you might, God forbid, need it. And then you go and you try to wire in, then they treat you like a criminal. And they make you go through all these hoops and bounds to prove who you are and to do all this ridiculous stuff that no other person would have to go through. You know, it's really, I'm trying to find the word, but it's like demeaning. It's like degrading, you know? And so this same, you know, we should be just as almost like gung-ho about a permissionless, openly accessibly dollar rail system than we are about Bitcoin, because it is wildly democratizing, you know, in ways that people don't understand. Like, even if you just had to wipe off the learning curve for what Bitcoin is, that in itself, to be able to on-ramp somebody in Nigeria without having to explain to them about Bitcoin, but just tell them, hey, it's a dollar. It works. Just send it and receive it. Like, I don't really understand, you know, I really think people comprehend how much easier that makes the onboarding process and explaining the value of a crypto to somebody. Like it's exponentially easier when you can do it in that rail and not have to go through, like the more esoteric you go, the harder it becomes. So you always want to pin it to something people know, relate to, have done before. And so a dollar is pretty ubiquitous, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That relatability factor just around Bitcoin savings, credit, collateral, and globalization, I think is huge. I'm going to round it out with a quote from Manuel Stotz, the founder of Kingsway Capital, who just led your latest round, your Series A $30 million raise. Having spent nearly a decade investing in emerging and frontier markets, we've had firsthand experience witnessing the power of disruptive technologies delivered to billions of consumers coming online for the very first time. The emergence of digital assets, whether via Bitcoin or US dollar stablecoins, is perhaps the greatest opportunity for financial inclusion, as well as an opportunity for a more decentralized and thus more equitable global internet. We are proud to support the talented team at Ledin in making this vision a reality and are honored to co-invest alongside such a world-class roster of global investors. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed this conversation, Maurizio. It's been an incredible honor to get to know you and, you know, work alongside your team. I see what you're building and bringing inclusive financial inclusion to people around the world, and opportunity is something that really, you know, I'm really stoked about, just because my background's in finance and accounting. And when I thought about finance, it wasn't just that I enjoyed working with numbers and learning about money, but I thought it was a tremendous way to help people. And the traditional and investment banking or commercial banking kind of abhorred me when I was coming out of college, and I veered towards accounting. And I think it's, you know, just really incredible to see, you know, financiers just building incredible products for the 21st century that actually, I think, really benefit people. I mean, nowhere can you get 9% on your dollar at a local bank, and building out this the Buy2X program and Bitcoin as collateral, I think is the future of finance. So it's been incredible.
Thank you so much, Cedric. I really, really appreciate it. And, you know, it's been a pleasure to work with your show. And I want to, we love people that do great content and really spend the time and asking the right questions and guiding people through a lot of, you know, You and many others that are in this space as educators, you guys are like, I see you guys as like you're shining the light into the darkness that a lot of people, you know, into the gaps of knowledge that a lot of people might have. And you guys are the pioneers in sort of experimenting with some of these services that may be unfamiliar to others and kind of sharing your experience. So I'm really, really happy to have been connected with you, and it's been a pleasure to work with you so far. And I just look forward to coming back on again.
Yeah. What's so great is the services are so familiar. It's just a different underlying asset. And I think it's awesome. Definitely let everyone know where they could find you and the services that Ledin offers.
Yeah. So you can check Ledin out. LEDN.io is our website. Our social media is at HODL with Ledin. And my personal social media is at Cryptonomista. So that's Cryptonomist with an A at the end. And I'm pretty active on Twitter. I write our newsletter every Monday called the Bitcoin Economic Calendar. Feel free to check it out. And we're out there. Just, you know, feel free to reach out if you have any questions on us and the services. And love to chat and answer any questions you guys have.
Thank you so much, Maurizio. This has been so dope. Maurizio de Bartolomeo on Venezuela, El Salvador, and Bitcoin is pristine collateral right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. This episode was brought to you by Ledin, Bitcoin Magazine, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth.
If you want to see what it's all about and get $50 free in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. Last year, over 10,000 Bitcoiners came to celebrate Bitcoin at Bitcoin 2021. But for Bitcoin 2022, they are expecting tens of thousands of rabid Bitcoiners. It's going to be off the hook, and I can't wait to see you all there. For 10% off, use my code CEDRIC2022. Check the show notes for the link and more details. Prices will continue to go up over time. You can follow the show on Twitter at DeLaBTCMatrix, and you can follow me on Twitter at SedYungleman. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, please make sure to subscribe, rate, review the show, and share with your friends and family. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused. This is Cedric. Peace.